Welcome to the Gila Mimbres Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring the listener a broad range of topics and expertise. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. The Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, or UGWA, is a watershed protection nonprofit group that's been around for almost 20 years. We work to protect the Gila River and its tributaries and the Gila National Forest through advocacy and by doing restoration projects. Today's show is about wilderness and why it's important. My guest is Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Welcome to Earth Matters, Nathan.
Thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
I should say that Nathan is going to be our third host and producer for this show. And today I'm interviewing him, but soon the listening audience will get the pleasure of listening to Nathan as he does his own show.
I'm looking forward to it.
So, Nathan, you work for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. What do they do, and how long has this group been around?
Yeah, I actually first started working for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance when I was 21 years old. And I worked for the organization for about 10 years before I took about a year and a half off and then just recently came back and started working down here in Silver City. The organization was founded in 1997, but prior to that, it was actually a big group of volunteers that included people like Dave Foreman and some other really renowned conservationists here in New Mexico. But officially, it's been around since 1997. And the organization is primarily focused on advocacy for wilderness protection of existing wilderness areas in New Mexico, as well as legislative protection to get new wilderness areas designated in New Mexico. And thus far, the organization has actually been quite successful in passing wilderness designation and or other forms of legislation. The most recently, we were successful in getting the Rio Grande del Norte National Monument designated up in northern New Mexico, and we're hopeful that other such designations will move forward into the future.
Mm-hmm. Where is that monument?
It's just outside of Cuesta near Taos up on the border with Colorado. It's about 300,000 acres of BLM land. Mm-hmm. There are two wilderness study areas that are within the National Monument that we're hoping will officially be designated as wilderness in the coming years.
How do you get land designated as wilderness? What's that process
like? It takes a very long time. as in most things with conservation, they take a long time. With wilderness, it really starts out at the grassroots level. You have to build the support locally for specific areas, and then after you've gotten that support, you then work with your elected leaders to get city councils to support them, to pass resolutions, to get county commissions to support them, and then on up the food chain all the way to Congress, where you have to get legislation drafted in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, and they have to be identical forms of legislation, and then they have to go through committees and then voted on through the full houses of Congress and then officially signed into law by the President of the United States. So in this climate with Congress now, nothing gets done, it seems like. So you can imagine how long it can take for just a single wilderness bill to get passed.
And that's a wilderness that's both within a national forest and on BLM land?
Yeah, a wilderness area can be designated on U.S. Forest Service land or on Bureau of Land Management land or even in a national parks land, too.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you really need to have a lot of patience and persistence in order to make this happen. It's not going to happen in a year or two.
Most definitely. I can give you an example. I worked on the Otero Mesa campaign for 10 years, and that place is still not permanently protected.
Yeah.
There's still no legislation in place to actually permanently protect it. So that's just one example of how long it can take. Sometimes these things are lifetimes.
Yeah. What's the status of the Desert Peaks Oregon Mountains National Monument?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that, because there actually is a hope for legislation to be drafted this fall and hopefully introduced in the Senate. There was a strong effort, as you may be aware, over the last couple of years to have wilderness designated, and then there was a push for a national monument because, again, Congress is not passing any legislation, and we're fortunate that the President of the United States does have the authority under the Antiquities Act of 1906 to designate areas as national monuments by signing a piece of paper, basically. So we're hopeful we'll be pushing for legislation. We'd like it to be legislated. If it cannot get through Congress, then we will certainly urged the president to designate it as a national monument through the Antiquities Act.
So it's easier to get a national monument designation than new wilderness areas?
No, I wouldn't say it's easier. Okay. It's just that it's easier for the president to use his authority and bypass Congress if Congress is unwilling or unable to act.
Yeah. So what is the importance of wilderness? I mean, why even bother to do all this work to get new wilderness areas? What's the big deal?
Well, the importance of wilderness, I suppose, is in the eye of the beholder. But, you know, living here in Silver City, only been here a month now, I feel privileged and honored to have the Gila Wilderness in my backyard. It's the first wilderness ever designated in the entire world. And if you stop and think about that for a moment, that's pretty profound to know that almost 100 years ago, a man named Aldo Leopold had the vision and foresight to say, hey, we need to stop going everywhere, chopping down every tree, poisoning every water system, mining everything, drilling for oil and gas everywhere. Wilderness, the importance of wilderness to me in my mind is it symbolizes freedom, the most quintessential form of freedom that you can actually experience in the United States of America is to be able to go walk into the woods where there's no roads, there's no cars, there's no pollution. It's you, your senses, it's the wildlife, it's the ground, it's the mountains. You know, these places are places of refuge, not just for the human spirit, but also for wildlife that depend on core wild areas to survive. And if we don't have wild places left in this country, I'm not sure, you know, there's really much more worth living for, in my opinion. It's almost like we've forgotten what it's like to be connected to the land. And so wilderness gives us that, and it gives the communities something to be inspired about and some place to go and seek refuge. But also, again, wilderness doesn't really necessarily have to have people for it to, you know, to be there to exist for itself. It exists for its own sake. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how I view it. It's like 100 years from now, when I'm no longer alive, I'd like to think that there are still wild places that people can go to and experience nature without the confines of man everywhere, all the way around them, having your cell phone with you all the time, you know, being connected to the internet all the time.
Right.
It's great to disconnect from that and to connect back to really your primal instincts, to where you really came from.
Yeah, yeah. It's great to be out in the wilderness and see like what it was like thousands of years ago. I mean, not that every place in wilderness is positively pristine, but but you know, as the population increases, there's so many more developed places, and it's so crucial to me to have wilderness preserved as a, you know, where you can go and see how things were.
And people, you know, move to New Mexico because they want to seek these places.
Right.
You know, people come to the West because they want to get away from the big cities and the hustle and the bustle.
Yeah.
I have a cousin that lives in Brooklyn, and when she came out here for the first time a couple of years ago, it just blew her mind away.
Right.
She was like, holy cow, I never knew you could see mountains like this and see 100 miles in the distance.
Yeah.
You can't see that in New York City.
Yeah. And there's no human infrastructure in those 100 miles that you can see either. It's just... it's how people saw it, you know, thousands of years ago.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's a great resource for people, wilderness is. But again, I just want to emphasize that wilderness exists in my mind for its own sake. It's really crucial that it just be allowed to exist on its own and not be messed around with.
Yeah, right. I agree. So your position with New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is the Gila grassroots organizer.
Yes.
What does that mean?
It's a very vague title, I know, but really, there's three sort of things that I'm looking to do while I'm working down here in Silver City, and hopefully I'm here for a long time. Number one is next year we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and there's going to be a conference, a national conference held here in New Mexico in Albuquerque that's going to draw, you know, 1,000 people from all over the country to come celebrate the 50th anniversary. So I'm hoping to organize people around the 50th anniversary and get them to participate, not only in the celebration, but in events leading up to the celebration.
Will some of those events for the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act be in the Silver City area, the Gila National Forest area, or are they all up north?
No, absolutely. I'm definitely going to be working very hard to organize events here in the Silver City area, most specifically to do projects in the Gila National Forest for the Gila Wilderness, for the Blue Range Wilderness, and for the Aldo Leopold Wilderness.
That seems totally appropriate since we do have the first wilderness area in the country and in the world, actually, like you said earlier.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's one key thing that I'll be working on is the 50th anniversary, bearing in mind that the 50th anniversary is also represents the 90th anniversary of the Gila Wilderness being designated back in June 3rd, 1924 by Aldo Leopold when he was still with the Forest Service here locally.
Well, I can't believe you know the exact date.
Yeah, I've been doing wilderness work for a long time.
Well, it's a good thing to know. I mean, we even have a high school here named after Aldo Leopold,
right.
and I'm sure probably most of those kids, when they come to school there, have really no idea who he is, but it's a well-named school and important to this area.
Absolutely.
And so do you work on other issues besides wilderness? I mean, you do work for the Wilderness Alliance, but is it mostly wilderness, or do you guys have any other issues that you work on?
It is primarily wilderness-related. Anything that's related to wilderness, we work on to the capacity that we can.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of wildlife species, obviously we're interested in the Mexican gray wolf program and how that program turns out. But there's other things that impact wilderness that, you know, people may not think actually relates to wilderness. For example, looking to work on a resource management plan or a land use management plan that the Forest Service may be doing. That's really kind of the wonky side of the work that I have to do.
I'll say.
It's not just the, you know, fun, touchy-feely, go out in the woods and do field work type of fun, but it's still the really important work that needs to be done to monitor what agencies are doing, where they want to go with their management plans, because these management plans will, you know, are on the books usually for 20, 25 years. And that's a, you know, generation for how an agency is going to manage, you know, our public lands. And so it's really important for us to be engaged in those processes. And I most certainly intend to do that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Gila National Forest's forest plan right now is from 1986.
Exactly.
And it was supposed to last for 10 years. I'd say they're just like a little bit behind schedule there.
Yeah, just a little.
Just a little. So, and like you said, it's really wonky stuff. So it's really great that there's somebody who's getting involved in this, because, I mean, some of those plans you have to read, they're hundreds of pages long. And let's face it, they're not really like very stimulating literature.
No.
So somebody has to do this work. So I'm really glad that you're going to be working on that forest planning, because it's a pretty big deal.
It is. And I my big hope is also to be able to sort of dumb it down a little bit for the public so that they can understand it and not make it so wonky and brainy and agency speak, because they use a lot of acronyms that people even know what they stand for. And they, like you said, there's a lot of redundancy in these documents where it's not like you're reading your favorite novel. You feel like you're reading a thesaurus, basically, or a dictionary. So my hope is that I can really explain it to people moving forward, and that way people get excited about being engaged in the process. Because while I'm one person that can understand it and disseminate information, it's more important that other people understand it as well and become engaged in the process, because that's really where the power lies in terms of trying to make an agency do the right thing.
Yeah. I wanted to get back to the Wilderness Act for just a minute. So you said that next year, 2014, is the 50th anniversary. Can you just talk a little bit about the significance of the Wilderness Act and maybe about its history a little bit?
Sure. The Wilderness Act, well, if you really want to talk about history, you have to go all the way back to Leopold. And when Leopold first came to the Southwest, you know, there were millions of acres of quote-unquote wilderness that was untouched, practically, by man. And he, at the time when he first came down here, he was of the opinion that we should be logging trees, we should be for building homes, we should be grazing cattle everywhere. And that that was his mentality for many years, until he started to slowly see the degradation occurring to the landscape. And he said, well, wait a minute, we need to slow down here, because if we don't stop, all this is going to be gone.
Right.
And, you know, these quote-unquote resources are there's nothing going to be left. And so we have to do something about this. And then in 1922, he submitted a proposal to the Albuquerque Regional Office of the Forest Service requesting that 755,000 acres in the headwaters of the Gila River and the Membres River be set aside as a wilderness area. Mm-hmm. And it took the Forest Service two more years in June 3rd of 1924 when they officially designated the Gila as a wilderness area. And then in 1948, unfortunately, Aldo Leopold died fighting a forest or a grass fire at his neighbor's house in Wisconsin. And he wasn't able to be around to see the passage of the Wilderness Act, which occurred in 1964, in September of 1964. Mm-hmm. And that effort was led by then-Senator Clinton P. Anderson, who was from New Mexico, another New Mexican champion the protection of wilderness areas. But that effort took, you know, 10 years to get it through Congress because mm-hmm. they had to do all these revisions to the language of the Wilderness Act, which is really eloquently written if you actually read the act. And the importance of that act is that it spawned a really international effort to protect areas as wilderness. And so the concept of wilderness began here in Silver City, in New Mexico, and then now it's a global phenomenon where yeah. you see countries all over the world designating areas as wilderness to save the last best places that we have on this earth.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, New Mexico is usually last in everything, but here yeah. we were first in something really important. So stay with us. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Earth Matters, the Gila Members Community Radio Show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm your host for today's show, Donna Stevens, and with me is Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and he kind of is a newcomer here in Silver City. I just had to get a little dig about your name there.
Appreciate that.
Funny. Yeah, I'm sure you do. Oh, we were talking before the break about the Wilderness Act and the significance of that. And I wonder if you could tell us what other kinds of issues you work on, what other kind of work you do in your position here that's more field work, where you're not sitting in front of your computer, but where you're actually out there in the beautiful wilderness.
Absolutely. That's the best part of the job, really, is doing field work. And that is going to be a big part of my job working down here in the Silver City region. We talked earlier a little bit about the land use management plans and resource management plans. The Gila National Forest is going to be updating their land use management plan in the coming years. And so it's really important that we gather field data to provide to the agency. And as you can imagine, you know, the Gila National Forest is like 3 to 4 million acres in size. For one person to go look at 3 to 4 million acres is going to take a lot of time. And so I can't do all that by myself, but I have to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I've already begun doing some field work. And what I look for when I go out there is I look for wilderness characteristics. I look for areas that might have very little impacts from human beings, or look for signs of wildlife. If you find mountain lion scat, for example, then you know you're in an area where predators are roaming fairly frequently. And if predators are roaming in an area, then you know that there's likely going to be game species out there like deer mm-hmm. and elk. And so that can give you a sense of kind of the health of the ecosystem when you're out there conducting field work and looking to see what other characteristics might qualify an area for being designated as wilderness or being designated as something else to help protect the resources, whether it's archaeological resources, cultural resources, wildlife resources, etc. Mm-hmm. So a big part of my job is to go out into the woods and carry around with me a little tablet, much like an iPad, and GPS my routes and take photo waypoints and take notes on what I'm looking at and what's there, if I ran into anybody, if I saw any problems or any abuses that were occurring. And over time, as you gather all this data, you end up with a healthy list of information that you can provide to the agency. Mm-hmm. And it's really important, that point, because the agency does not have the funding or the staff to send somebody out into the woods to collect this kind of data. They just don't. I mean, they spend most of their money, rightly or wrongly, fighting fires, and they don't have the cash to go do the real work that needs to be done, especially when you're talking about updating a land use management plan. So the field work is a critical component to ensuring that we get the best data possible to the agency.
So you're looking, when you go out there, you're looking for healthy lands, like healthy watersheds and wildlife, and what other types of things are you looking for?
Yeah, I'm looking for those things, but I'm also looking for wilderness characteristics. And wilderness characteristics consist of a couple of different things, and they're all very subjective. Mm-hmm. One is naturalness. If you read the Wilderness Act, it says the area, you know, they appear natural in their natural state. Well, okay.
What does that mean?
Yeah, does the area appear natural? Does it appear that there are very few impacts from human beings? Mm-hmm. You know, if you see roads everywhere, or if you see fencing everywhere, or stock tanks everywhere, then of course that's going to diminish an area's naturalness per se. But if you don't see those things and the area appears predominantly natural, that is one of the characteristics of a wilderness area. Solitude is another characteristic. If you're out in an area and you see hundreds of people, you're definitely probably not going to find very much solitude. But if you go into an area and you don't see anybody for the entire day, well, that certainly meets one of the criteria for wilderness is solitude. And other outstanding forms of primitive recreation. It doesn't have to just be solitude. It can be hunting. It can be fishing. It can be kayaking, horseback riding. I mean, all these different things that people can do in wilderness areas. And so mm-hmm. you're looking for those types of experiences or qualities that you can document while you're out there conducting field work.
So if you see something that looks like it's human infrastructure, like stock tanks or roads, does that disqualify that land as wilderness?
No, not necessarily. If you have, for example, just take the Gila Wilderness. You've got a road that goes all the way up to the Gila Cliff Dwellings. But on either side of the road, it's the Gila Wilderness. And so that road is what we call a cherry stem. It was cherry stemmed in to allow access for people to get in, basically up to the heart of the Gila Wilderness. But if you had, like, you know, more than roads like that all over the place, well, then of course, yes, it would definitely disqualify an area from being designated as wilderness. The key thing is it has to be at least 5,000 contiguous acres of land. That's the first criteria for an area to even be considered being designated as wilderness. It has to be at least 5,000 contiguous acres or a certain number of acres that is immediately adjacent to an existing wilderness.
So that's what I was just going to ask.
Yes.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to be 5,000 acres that currently aren't designated as wilderness.
Right. You could have, say, 400 acres that are, like, right off the existing Gila Wilderness that are just as wild as the Gila Wilderness that could easily be added to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then once you decide on what areas that you think are appropriate for wilderness, then you approach the agency? The Forest Service?
Yeah, first you approach the agency, but at the same time, you're also hopefully talking with the community and getting people's input and taking people out to these areas and getting their perspectives on it and see if they feel the same way. And that way you can have buy-in. And it's not just, you know, one guy with the last name Newcomer telling people what to do. But yeah, absolutely. You go to the agencies and you provide them with the information and you give them your rationale. And that's what the process of field work is you have the hard scientific data that follows their criteria of what they specifically ask when they're doing field work. I mean, you follow their guidelines, so it's not like you're making things up. You're actually doing the work for them.
Right.
Because again, they don't have the funding or the resources, so you might as well try and make it as easy as possible for them by following their steps.
Right. Yeah, especially when you're talking about wilderness areas where you have to hike in long distances or get packed in. That stuff takes a lot of time, and they don't necessarily, like you said, have the funding to do that.
Right.
So that sounds like a pretty good job, Nathan.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I'm very, very happy.
How much of that have you already done in the Gila?
Very little at this point.
Okay.
I've only been here, again, a month, and most of that time has been spent just trying to get my feet landed on the ground and meet people and paperwork, basically.
Right.
But I have done a little bit up on the Cherry Creek area, which is near the Ben Lilly Memorial. I looked at that area a couple of times, a couple of miles in there.
Yeah.
That's some nice country in there, too, and actually did find some evidence of bear and mountain lion in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but you've done this work in other forests, is
sure
that
have.
Right?
Yeah, I spent about a year doing field work in the Cibola National Forest, which is based out of Albuquerque, although the Cibola is a very unique national forest because it's nine different mountain ranges spread throughout multiple counties in central New Mexico. And I focus primarily on the San Mateo Mountains and the Magdalena Mountains, which are just to the northeast of the Gila, and spent a lot of time out there looking at wilderness characteristics and found a lot of wild country. Actually saw two mountain lions one day.
Wow.
In the San Mateos.
You sure it was a different lion, or was it the same one?
Positive it's two different lions, because the first one, actually, I wasn't even sure. I was like, what is that? I was driving down this old road, and I saw this animal running through this canyon, and I did the most stupidest thing in the world. I got out of my truck and ran after it to see if I could get a better look at it.
This is what not to do, boys and girls.
Right. But it ran away from me, obviously. It was running away from me, and I saw it, and I was like, that's not a dog. That's not running like a dog. So it wasn't a dog. It wasn't a coyote. And I just couldn't figure it out. I was like, could that be a mountain lion? I'm not sure. Well, I drove like 30 miles away from that location up to a ridge line, and I set up my camp, and I was walking down this old road. The sun was setting, and all of a sudden this mountain lion just jumped right across the road in front of me, literally like 15 feet away from me, and it was like, oh my God. And so I knew when I saw that second one, the first one was definitely a mountain lion. It's the most beautiful experience of my life.
Wow,
and
that's great.
Just saw this wild animal, you know, booking it through the woods, trying to get as far away from me as possible.
That's a true wilderness experience.
Yes, it was.
You don't get that in downtown LA.
No, you don't.
Well, not usually.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. So I know that there's some kind of misperceptions about the kinds of activities that can take place in wilderness areas. Like, for instance, I know people say, well, you can't graze cattle in wilderness. But, I mean, I've been in the wilderness, and there are definitely cows out there. So can you talk about what's permissible and what isn't?
Yeah, that's a falsehood that's been perpetuated for some very long time. The Wilderness Act specifically states that if grazing is occurring in an area prior to it being designated as wilderness, that grazing will continue, and that, in fact, grazing will be grandfathered in.
Yeah.
And so grazing is definitely allowed to occur in wilderness areas. And as you said, you see signs of cattle in wilderness areas all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, grazing can occur in wilderness areas. I mentioned earlier, a couple other things. Hunting, you can hunt in a wilderness area. You can go horseback riding in a wilderness area. You can fly fish. You can canoe. You can raft, backpack, hike. All those things are allowed. Anything that just doesn't, damage the existing resources out there is basically allowed in a wilderness area.
What about mining? Can you do mining?
Only if there was an actual mining claim that was previously staked in the area prior to becoming a wilderness area, then those valid existing rights do apply. They still are valid.
Mm-hmm.
And, because that's federal government cannot go in and take somebody's valid claim or take someone's private property. That's just not, you can't do that. So yes, that could occur if there was a valid existing claim, but hopefully there aren't any.
Yeah. So if somebody did have a mining claim, would they'd have to walk in then to get to it?
Yes, they would.
Okay.
They would.
Yeah. So what about mountain biking? Can you mountain bike in wilderness?
No, you cannot mountain bike in wilderness. And that's a mechanized form of travel, and anything that's mechanized is not allowed in a wilderness area.
Uh-huh. And so I guess there also are no roads and nobody's driving in wilderness.
They better not be.
They better not
They're
be.
They're breaking the law if they are.
right. Well, I mean, that's the beauty of it because, there's roads everywhere. You can see, if you go to Google Earth, you can see roads. I mean, they're just all over the place. And so
an interesting point on that is that there are more miles of roads on our national forest system land than there are in the entire United States interstate system.
Wow.
Think about that. There's more roads in our national forest, more miles of roads in our national forest than there are in the entire country in terms of our interstate system.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Wait, isn't this supposed to be a forest?
It's unbelievable. So. And you hear people screaming about access. It's like, you've got access.
Right.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you would see a place that has a whole bunch of roads or... Could some of those roads be closed for that area to become wilderness?
Most definitely. Just to give you an example, when I was doing work in the Cibola, I was looking at roads. I was walking down old roads because the Forest Service was doing the travel management planning at the time, and I was trying to collect data for them to say, okay, this road is clearly not passable. I mean, I walked down this old road. There's large ponderosa trees that are falling all over the place. There's washout everywhere.
Yeah.
You couldn't even drive an ATV back in there, let alone would you want to. It's super dangerous.
Yeah.
And so you can definitely provide information to the agency with photographic documentation and with your field notes and give them that information and say, hey, yes, this road is clearly not in use, or it doesn't need to be used because you've got these other two that are already being used for the exact same purpose. Mm-hmm. And so you can make those justifications to close and obliterate some roads that we don't need anymore, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show, and my guest is Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Nathan, can you talk a little bit more about some of the activities that are going to be associated with the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act?
Absolutely.
In 2014?
Absolutely. Specifically here down in the Silver City area, I'm trying to get some projects set up with the Forest Service because they're going to be doing the celebration too, the agency. They'll have like a PowerPoint projection or presentation rather. They'll have like booths at events all over the town. But I was talking with them and trying to get them to think, you know, bigger picture and say, well, why don't we actually do some projects? And they're like, okay, that's actually a good idea. So a couple of projects that we have in the works are to do some citizen monitoring and surveys out in the Blue Range wilderness for invasive species that are slowly creeping into the wilderness. And so we don't want those there. So we're going to go out there, survey the areas, remove the weeds that we find. And we're also going to be doing some signage in the Blue Range, because the signage for that particular wilderness is fairly poor. And the Forest Service has had instances of illegal access from ATVs, from people riding their ATVs in the wilderness. And so we're going to put signs up saying, you know, no ATVs. We're going to erect some barriers to hopefully mm-hmm. prevent people from going in there. So that's one example. Another example is, I met this really nice woman that works for the Forest Service out in Glenwood, and she came up with this idea to do like a wilderness ranger trip. Like, what would it be like to be a Forest Service wilderness ranger? And when she said that to me, I was like, I felt like I was a kid again, you know, in the Boy Scouts. I was like, are you kidding me? Of course I'd love to go do that. And so what we're going to do is open it up to, you know, maybe a dozen people, because we can't take that many. But the concept is to have the Forest Service pack in all our stuff with mules and horses, which is great. Go in like 5 miles, set up a base camp, and then the next couple of days, spend our life pretending we're wilderness rangers. And we'll be doing trail work. We'll be cleaning up campsites. We'll be blazing a new trail. We'll be doing some more surveys, looking to find and collect data. And do that for like 3 or 4 days. So that's one. That's another example. Other ideas that we're trying to do is to get some projects to actually close some illegal roads that are poaching into the Gila and the Aldo Leopold through the North Star Road. There's a mm-hmm. couple of sections up there that the agency has concerns about with people going in there. And so we hope to do that as an educational project as well, but also something that's giving back in a way to the land by helping to prevent illegal activity.
Well, the Wilderness Ranger trip really sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes, it does.
Are there still Wilderness Rangers?
That's a great question. There's probably very few of them. They're going the way of the fire lookout tower guy
right.
as well, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But there is, I know there is a wilderness district here in the
right.
Gila, obviously, out in the Membrace Valley. And they do have a wilderness ranger, but there's probably only a handful of them left.
Yeah, I don't think they really get to get out into the wilderness as much as they would like.
Probably not.
Yeah. So, but I know that there are old cabins out in what's now the Gila Wilderness, and those were like Forest Service ranger stations back before the Wilderness Act was passed. And now they're just kind of in the middle of nowhere, and it's really, really hard for me to picture that anybody would go to work at those places every day. And it's like, well, how did they even get there? Because they're way out there.
Horse.
And I guess they stayed there for a long
yeah.
time. They didn't
yeah.
commute every
no,
day.
No, they were there for weeks on end, probably.
Yeah, wow. That would have been quite the job.
Imagine
back in the
life,
day,
right?
huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So have you had any experiences when you're out in the wilderness that could be kind of similar to what a wilderness ranger would have experienced?
Yeah. When you do field work, it's pretty much like being a wilderness ranger when you're out there, sometimes for a week or sometimes longer than that.
Yeah.
One time I was doing some field work and I backpacked into an area. I was probably about 6 miles in from a road, and I was going down this old road that was clearly gone. It was a game trail now, mm-hmm. and there was blue gramma grass everywhere. And as I started going down this canyon, the canyon wall started getting thinner and thinner, and it's just like brushes everywhere. And I'm like, okay, this is getting a little sketchy. So I'm starting to like sing and like say things really loud, just like to announce myself right. if there's anything here. And then I come across a water source. And I'm in the San Mateo Mountains, and there's hardly any water in the San Mateo Mountains. So to find fresh flowing water for like 500 feet is a rare sign. And I'm like, okay, now this is getting a little more hairy. And as I get out of that canyon, finally it opens up, take off my backpack, and I pull out my tablet, and I turn on my GPS, and I take this picture of this old cattle corral that's just sagging, and it's, you know, certainly not being used. And there's gramma grass like 4 feet high everywhere. It's just beautiful. And after I take this picture of this cattle corral, because I'm documenting human impacts, right? This black bear walks out of the woods to my left. He's literally 10 feet away from me.
Wow.
Stops, turns, and stares at me. And I'm like, oh my God, this is it. I'm going to die. This is the moment. And I'm staring at this bear. I see his eyes. His eyes are glowing from the sunlight. I'm like, okay, don't look at his eyes. Look away. Do what they tell you to do. And
look big, huh?
Yeah, take a step back. I had a knife on the ground that I pick up. You know, I hold up my arms, and I'm like yelling at this animal. It doesn't do anything. Huh. It just stares at me. And it's just the most frightening experience of my life. And I'm just yelling and yelling and yelling. He finally takes a move like he's going to leave, but he stops, turns around, and stares at me again. I'm like, okay, this is the real moment where I'm actually going to die because he didn't leave. He's actually going to come at me. I'm screaming as loud as I possibly can at this animal, and finally he leaves, and I run back to my backpack, and I take another picture of where I was, and I looked at the timestamp from when I took that photo of the corral, and when I took the picture of the after the incident, and it was 6 minutes.
Wow.
Bear and I were staring at each other. It was the most crazy experience of my life. By
probably
far.
The longest 6 minutes
longest
of your life
6
ever.
Minutes of my life ever.
I thought you were going to say 15 seconds.
No.
It seemed like forever,
no,
but it really was a long
was
time
6 minutes.
For him to be staring at you.
I don't think that bear had ever seen a human being in his life. I mean...
Oh, you think that's what it was?
I honestly don't think
he didn't know what to make of you.
I mean, I was in the middle of nowhere, literally, and nobody goes to the San Mateo Mountains except for hunters and, you know, certain parts of the season. And I was in, you know, in the backwoods.
Yeah.
And this was a big animal. And I'm next to a water source, so...
Right. You know animals are going to be showing up there.
They're going to be showing up.
Yeah.
So I did my field work as fast as humanly possible and left.
Yeah, I was out in the Gila Wilderness at the end of May. And we were out there. There was three of us, though. We weren't alone. And I wasn't alone. And... we were out there for 6 days, and we didn't see one other person. And, it, you know, it's very nice weather, and it was fairly easy to get to. But a lot of times, there's just nobody out there. And I call it a private planet, and it's just the best, you know? I mean, because if you don't have a lot of money, if you don't own a whole lot of land, the wilderness is great for just getting out there and getting away from everybody.
Yeah.
It wasn't until we got to within, when we were walking out, on our last day, we got about half a mile from the trailhead, and there were two people there. But we hadn't seen anybody for days.
It's a great feeling, isn't it?
It's really great, yeah. We're really fortunate to be able to have those kinds of experiences.
Absolutely.
And I know there is some opposition to designating more wilderness areas, because some people feel like you only would have access to wilderness if you're... I've heard people say things like, oh, it's only the green people who can get in there, and people who are really young and fit backpackers. And so there really is some kind of pushback to designating more wilderness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Why you think people are opposed?
Sure. I think a lot of it has to do with just misunderstanding what wilderness actually is. When we did a lot of work up in the northern part of the state, we ran, like with the Rio Grande del Norte National Monument, for example, at first there were ranchers that were opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took time. You just had to educate, sit down with them and say, look, we're not trying to, you know, remove your cattle here.
Mm-hmm.
We understand this is your livelihood. We understand this is your cultural way of life. So, you know, let's try and find a way to work together. And we believe that wilderness is a way that we actually can work together. And over time, just developing relationships with these people, they were able to see that actually wilderness was a benefit to them, because in fact it was going to grandfather their grazing rights in to the actual designation.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really, it comes from a long history of just misunderstanding and bad experiences, perhaps, and maybe folklore that sort of gets passed down through generations about things that are and are not. You know, some people just don't like wilderness, and you're never going to change their minds, and that's a fact. And it's unfortunate that you can't work with those people. But there are other people that have a little bit of the door open. They're still willing to listen and talk reasonably about what the benefits of wilderness are. And look, maybe wilderness isn't great everywhere. I'm not saying that it is. There are certainly areas where it shouldn't be designated because it's a playground for off-road vehicles. That's fine. That's perfectly fine. As we said earlier, there's plenty of roads in the national forest system for people to go driving around.
Yeah.
But if you look at New Mexico and you look at the landmass of the state and you look at the acreage of wilderness that we have designated, only 2.1% of our state is actually permanently protected as wilderness. So to say that, like, you know, there's no place to go drive my ATV, or there's no place to like get out into the woods because there's wilderness everywhere, it's just plain false, because there's very little wilderness in New Mexico.
2% of the entire landmass.
2.1% of New Mexico's public.
That's pretty small.
Yeah, it's very small. In fact, we're just about the bottom in the terms of the Western United States of how much wilderness we have protected.
Really?
Even though we're the birthplace of wilderness.
Right. That's kind of sad.
I hope to change that.
Yes. That's your mission, isn't it?
That's my job.
So what other types of projects are you working on with the agencies? Are they only these projects that will be for forest planning and for the wilderness celebration, the 50th anniversary?
Well, I hope that we can obviously do more than that, because the 50th will come and it'll be gone.
Right.
And so looking into the future, yeah, most certainly I hope to be doing a lot of other projects that don't necessarily have to be with the Forest Service. They can certainly be with other local conservation groups like UGWA, for example, and doing some stream restoration projects and planting willows. I think that those are all certainly within the confines of my job and certainly would be appropriate to do. So I definitely hope that we can do projects like that in the future. And there's also, you know, BLM land that's over here too. You got the whole Boot Hill region, which has a ton of wilderness study areas. And they're going to be doing their resource management plan in the coming years, more likely.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, that's probably further on down the road, you know, maybe 5-10 years down the road, but still, it's something that's going to be coming up. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, wilderness designation takes a long time, so you might as well get started early and get a foot up on it.
And hope you live a long time.
Well, you know, at least do the best you can before you go.
What is a wilderness study area, a BLM wilderness study area?
That's a good question. A BLM wilderness study area is an area that the agency actually identified as possessing wilderness characteristics in their land use management plan. Back in the 70s, there was a law that was passed by Congress that directed the Bureau of Land Management to do wilderness inventories. And so they did all those inventories back in the 70s. And they've been sort of stuck, or just all these wilderness study areas are just sitting out there waiting for Congress to either designate them or not designate them. The BLM can't designate them. They don't have the authority to do that. Only Congress can do that, and only the president can make it actually law. So these WSAs, as we call them, wilderness study areas, are just kind of sitting out there waiting for Congress to do something with them. In the meantime, though, the agency is supposed to be managing them for their wilderness characteristics and not allowing activities to degrade those characteristics. So, in effect, they're de facto wilderness.
So they couldn't, for instance, put a new road in there or let somebody start a new mine or something.
They
in those
should
WSAs.
Not. No, they should not be doing that unless there's some extreme circumstance that they had to do it for something. One example is there was a WSA in Doniana County that went all the way to the border, and there was concern that Border Patrol wouldn't have, you know, access. And our senators actually rewrote the language for the legislation to sort of eliminate a little buffer zone that would still be a part of the wilderness study area, but it would allow the agency, the Border Patrol agency, to go through there.
That's the Desert Peaks, Oregon Mountains monument you're talking about?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. There's a WSA, I believe it's the West Potrillo Mountains, that's Okay. Goes all the way down to the border.
Yeah, so they just took out a little buffer.
Yeah, they made like a 2 mile buffer zone, something like that, that uh-huh. would enable the Border Patrol to drive.
Yeah, so then the Border Patrol was they were on board with this new monument designation.
They were in support of it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I understand that the City Council of Las Cruces and Sunland Park and El Paso, and Doniana County were all in favor of this designation.
It's very
too.
Popular in Doniana County. The vast majority of Las Cruces support wilderness and support national monument designation for the Oregon Mountains and their surrounding landscapes, for sure.
Yeah. Weren't there people who were in support of it because they thought it would bring more tourist income to their county?
Absolutely. The recreational tourism industry in New Mexico is $6.1 billion annually.
That's a lot of dough.
It's a lot of dough. That's more than agriculture and farming bring to the state of New Mexico.
Really?
It's $4 billion. So it's $2 billion more that outdoor recreation and tourism brings to the land of enchantment. And predominantly people are coming here to play outside.
Right, because they don't have that where they live.
Exactly.
I mean, there isn't wilderness everywhere.
Exactly.
So, and, you know, we're not making any more.
No, we're not. Maybe in Hawaii, but nowhere
right.
else.
Right. So we'll be right back. We're going to talk about wilderness some more, and we'll come back from our break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. I'm your host for today's show, Donna Stevens. I'm the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. And with me, I have Nathan Newcomer, who is with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and in a few weeks will be the third producer host of Earth Matters. So I'm really excited to hear some of your shows, Nathan. I'm sure they'll be different than what I've been doing. So I wanted to ask you about fires, because fires are such a huge part of what's going on in our national forests these days. And I'm wondering if how the Forest Service deals with fires in wilderness is different than their policy on the rest of the forest that's outside of wilderness areas.
That's an excellent question, Donna, and a really great topic to talk about. The Gila is very unique in this sense. Because you have a very large, roadless, wild area, almost 500,000 acres, basically, that fire can actually do its natural thing when there is a natural fire caused by lightning. The Forest Service, as we all know, has been suppressing fire throughout the western United States for the last 100 years. Every time there was a fire, that was the 10 a.m. rule, that the Forest Service would imply. Put it out by 10 a.m. If it wasn't out by 10 a.m. that day, put it out the next day by 10 a.m. It was always put it out by 10 a.m. And they would throw everything they possibly could at putting this fire out. There was a fire in the Gila years ago, many years ago, probably 50, 60 years ago, that brought in, you know, Fort Bliss troops to put this thing out.
Really? And
yeah, I think it was the McKnight fire. Back in the 50s, they brought in all these people, thousands of people, to put out this fire. And that area, actually, that they were fighting the fire was what burned this summer. The Silver Fire was it's the same area. And the Silver Fire, that area hadn't burned in 100 years. Mm-hmm. And Philip Connors, the author here locally from Silver City, wrote about that specific area in his book, ironically enough, saying that it was the one area in the forest that needed to burn because it hadn't burned in 100 years. And lo and behold, a couple of years later, it actually does go up.
What area specifically are you talking
Sawyer's
about?
Sawyer's Peak, just south of Emory Pass, and then it went north and into the Aldo Leopold.
Yeah.
But to get back to your initial question about how the Forest Service manages fire in wilderness versus the broader national forest, the Gila, again, is very unique in this sense because it is so large and they can actually let fire go to see how it's going to behave and to see if it can actually regain its naturalness in the course of the forest. Other places, they don't do that. Like if you have a fire in the Sandia Mountains outside of Albuquerque, oh no, they put that thing out in a heartbeat. They don't want to see that thing grow and burn down people's homes right up against the mountain. And that's sort of the delicacy that the Forest Service is having to face now. They've realized that they can't suppress everything anymore because it's going to create catastrophic fires like we're seeing now. But then at the same time, you know, they want to let the fire regime get back into its natural role. And they're doing that here in the Gila. And it's sort of it's a new concept for them. They're not quite sure how to go with it sometimes, when to let a fire burn, when to not let it burn. It's sort of a guessing game to them sometimes, taking a fate of chance. Obviously, they'd like to have fires burning when it's, you know, monsoon season and not in the spring where the winds are gusting at 50 miles an hour every day and it's just super dry out there. But that's typically when these fires are occurring, is in the spring. If you look at the Silver Fire, though, for example, the burn severity maps for the Silver Fire show that there was really only one big high burn area, and that was at Sawyer's Peak where the fire started, where it was mostly dense, dead juniper and pinon. As the fire spread north into the actual Aldo Leopold Wilderness, it started to moderately die out, and it just spread, but it was a good burning fire that actually cleaned out all, you know, the stuff that didn't need to be there. It got out the low trees and didn't burn all the high canopy stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think that the Forest Service is trying to get their hands around this issue, and it's good to see that they are. The Silver Fire is, I think, a good example. We'll have to see in the coming years how bad it was. But I think it was a pretty good fire, and it's nice to see that the Forest Service here, at least locally, has the tools and the capability to allow fire to burn because we have such big wilderness areas already designated in the Gila.
So I know there were a lot of people over there fighting that fire for weeks. So were they mostly fighting areas that were adjacent to people's homes and to other human infrastructure?
Yeah, it's really, they're trying to contain it. They sort of like, they build containment lines. And at some points, you know, if the fire is just burning too hot, you can't do anything about it.
Right.
You know, you can drop slurry on it, you can drop water on it, but there's no sense to send people out there to go fight it because it's just dangerous. Lose your life. Like those 19 firefighters in Arizona did this summer. I believe that the majority of the work was just trying to build containment lines. And to protect the people, the homes and property in Hillsborough, obviously, was a big concern.
Right.
And to look at where the fire, because after the fire, the big concern is obviously the downstream flooding from all the debris that we have right now that's occurring because all the monsoon moisture is coming back. So I think that those were the two main two pieces of work that were being done by firefighters was the containment of the fire to sort of try and prepare for where they think it was going to go, and then the protection of people's home and property.
So could they, for the areas of the Silver Fire that were in the Aldo Leopold Wilderness area, can they drop slurry in the wilderness?
Yes, they
do
can.
That?
They do.
Okay,
they
so
do.
That's the same as in the rest of the forest.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Okay, but they didn't have people going in there, I mean, you know, at a place that would be miles inside of the wilderness. There was really no point in fighting the fire there.
They may have had people doing that. I don't know specifically.
Uh-huh.
But again, just by looking at the burn severity maps, if the Aldo Leopold Wilderness, the portions of it that burned, they burned from moderate to low, and so that's a sign that the fire was doing its job.
Right, that's what we want to
right,
have happen.
Right, we want it to clean out all the brush and the dead things that are there, so that new stuff can grow back up.
Yeah,
and what we're probably going to see is, you know, in 40 years from now, the Silver Fire is going to be one giant aspen stand, which will be probably really pretty.
Yes. Well, I was out towards the end of May. I was saying earlier, I was out in the Gila Wilderness in the Mogollon Creek watershed, and I was at a lot of places that burned really hot last year. I mean, it was definitely a mosaic, real patchwork of what burned and what didn't burn and different severities. But some of the places I walked through, the ground was completely black, and when I walked through there, my shirt got just all black with all the ash, but there was already stuff coming up. And that fire just happened last year. And what I did see is that it looked like a lot of the junipers and pinons were dead, a lot of pinons, and some of the big ponderosas survived, as they're supposed to, because they're fire adapted. But it looked like a lot of what used to be like maybe pinon juniper was going to come back as an oak woodland, because the oaks all stump sprouted and they were going for it. And there were all kinds of wildflowers coming up as well. And that was before the monsoons even started. So I mean, it's not like it's a wasteland out there. There's definitely stuff happening still.
Yeah, it's a process, and it takes years for it to go through it. And, you know, while it may be unfortunate for us because we may not see it the same way again in our lifetime, it'll take care of itself.
Yeah.
You know, and but the hope is that hopefully moving forward that we can get away from these large, gigantic fires and just have fire occurring more frequently at smaller scales. That way the function of the ecosystem can actually regain control and do its thing.
Yeah. I didn't even think that it looked ugly, really. I mean, yeah, there were a lot of dead trees, but there was so much already coming back. There was one whole hillside that was nothing but smooth sumac over the entire hillside, and I didn't actually even find it depressing because there was already things coming back a year later.
And what's interesting to note is that when there is a burn area, that's usually the first area that elk and deer will go back to because the grasses will come up really strong when they officially do come up.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you if there's anything else, any other projects that New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is working on that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah. Some of the other projects that we're working on, up north, there's a campaign to protect the Columbine Hondo Wilderness Study Area, which is immediately adjacent to the Latier Peaks Wilderness and the Wheeler Peak Wilderness, which is the tallest mountain in New Mexico, Wheeler Peak is.
Right.
Columbine Hondo is about 45,000 acres. It's a Forest Service area with lakes really nice up there. Down in the south, again, there's the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument campaign. We're very hopeful about that. And, of course, there's still Otero Mesa that's out there and an issue that this organization is engaged in. I personally am not working on that campaign because I've got 4 million acres to work on. Otero Mesa is another million acres, so I don't need to have that on my plate. But that's still an issue that this organization is deeply concerned about. Other things that we do that aren't, you know, really the sexy kind of campaigns that people like to hear about is the wonky stuff. We do a lot of agency wonk where we review environmental assessments, we review environmental impact statements, resource management plans. We're looking at all of these things all the time because hardly anybody else is doing that. And it's important that we make sure we keep the agency, you know, agencies rather in line and make sure they're doing the right thing and not doing the bad things.
Yeah. Where does New Mexico Wilderness Alliance get its funding from?
Most of our funding comes from grants and contributions. Like most nonprofits, we have to write grants to foundations, and sometimes they're really tiny foundations, sometimes they're really large foundations, and so it varies from who we get our cash from, but we also get contributions from our membership and from the public. We don't receive any funding from the government at all, and never have. Not that we're opposed to it. It's just that it's a lot more hurdles to jump through, and reporting process is like filling out a textbook. So we tend to rely on the decency and the kindness of others to help our organization do the work that we do. And we're really actually fortunate to have a fairly large membership base in the state of 5,000 members.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So if people want to find out more about the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, do you have a website they could go to?
We certainly do. That is nmwild.org. Again, nmwild.org.
Great. Well, I think we're just about out of time here, folks. So thanks for joining us today. Thank you, Nathan,
for
being here. And I look forward to hearing your shows in the future.
Me too. Thanks.